Over the millennia, humans have worshipped the sun as a god, built cities dedicated to its majesty, attempted to harness its power, and have been stupefied by its mysteries. But how much do we really know about the star at the center of our planetary system? For the last 8 years, Richard Cohn has dedicated himself to all things solar, and his new book, Chasing the Sun, The Epic Story of the Star That Gave Us, is published by Random House. I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Cohn to our show today. Welcome. It's that gave us life. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
It gave us life, I should have said.
I was going to point out you missed out life.
You're not a scientist, are you?
I'm not. I had to pretty well learn my science from scratch.
You're a publisher?
I was a publisher for 25 years or more and always wanted to read about the sun.
So why was it difficult to find someone to write a book about the sun? Well, what kind of book were you imagining?
I really wanted a book that told me everything, not just the science, which I was particularly ignorant about, but the sun seemed to get into every area of our life, and I wanted to read a book that would reflect that.
So did you feel you had no choice but to write it yourself?
I tried when I was a publisher to get a couple of people writing about the sun in the way I wanted, and they said, well, you're right, the book doesn't exist. And I went to the New York Public Library, and there were nearly 6,000 books under the index heading sun. But none of them did what I wanted. So I felt the only way I'm going to read this book is if I write it myself.
Did you literally chase the sun, as your title suggests?
I did. I was lucky in that I got a grant from the Sloan Foundation here in New York, which exists to further people's general understanding of science. So I was able to travel to all these places.
Well, isn't the sun no matter where you go?
Well, in one sense, of course it is. But in another sense, it's wonderfully different. For instance, in 2003, I travelled down to Cape Town and from there took a decommissioned Aleutian 76 plane to Antarctica. And we dropped in between two huge storms that had knocked away most of the tents and planes that were there normally. And we arrived just in time to see the solar eclipse. And that's unlike any other way of looking at the sun. It's extraordinary. You can imagine why in previous centuries people were so terrified of the sun being put out.
But we've had eclipses even here in New York during my lifetime, although not for a while. It is an extraordinary thing, but I just remember being told, don't look directly at the sun.
It's interesting. When there was an eclipse visible from London, the doctors at the main eye hospital could tell the exact stage of the eclipse by looking at people's eye injuries, and they could see from where it was injured what the timing was. But in Antarctica, I was watching the moon put out the sun, and all around me was ice, and then on the horizon, wherever I looked, this fluorescent blue glow. Mm. That's very different from watching things in New York.
So how old is this star that we call the sun?
Well, we're all older than the sun in one respect, inasmuch that we have atoms in us which are older than the sun's existence.
Although the sun has atoms dating back to that time as well, because it all dates back to the Big Bang, doesn't it?
Well, certainly. I mean, the sun is 5.5 billion years old.
And how do we know that?
Well, I'm going on the authority. I'm not a cosmologist or an astronomer. I'm going on the authority of numerous astronomers, and they can tell by examining, not least, the light we get from the sun and the various minerals or deposits that make up the sun show themselves in the quality of light that reaches us.
And that's how we can determine age?
We can determine age. We can determine the makeup of the sun. But there's still a huge amount about the sun that we don't know.
So the sun is different now than it was when, let's say, 1 million years ago or 5 million years ago or 100 million years ago.
In some senses, yes.
Is it using up its resources?
Well, we thought so for hundreds of years. One of the great questions was, how does the sun get its energy? And people realized it wasn't on fire. It wasn't burning itself. Then it really would have eaten itself up. It's nuclear fission. And that's going to run out eventually, but as I say, in another 5.5 billion years. So you'll be okay.
Does it rotate?
Yeah. And one of the points which is interesting about it is we get sunspots, and we're in over the next 2 years for a new burst of sunspot activity, which is going to affect weather on Earth. And you can see the sunspots as the sun rotates and the sunspots move across its surface.
In some ways, it's unique because there's a possibility that this is the only star that has life in the planet surrounding it, although we're not sure. But there are a lot of stars that are similar to our sun, aren't there?
You were lied quickly of the we're not sure. One of the things which comes out of talking to astronomers is our technology is getting so advanced and so subtle and so powerful that we're finding out more and more about other places where hundreds, thousands, millions of years hence, the human race may be able to transfer to.
You mentioned the sunspots. Haven't they been correlated to large social upheavals throughout history?
They've been correlated to everything from revolutions, French Revolution, the American Revolution, which are said to have happened at the time of large sunspot activity.
And you say we're about to have some large sunspot?
Yeah. So
that's after this latest election here in the United States. I would have assumed that the election results were the result of sunspot activity.
I'm not sure that any relation has been made between the Tea Party and the sun as yet, but you never know.
The sun has been worshipped as a deity. Well, by the way, do we have any idea why sunspots and social upheavals have occurred simultaneously?
Well, there are theories that the effect of the sunspots, and this includes looking at it in a larger way, solar flares, solar winds, solar magnetism, all of these have an effect on the Earth, affect people's moods, their psychological swings, but it affects everything from crop performance to the number of rabbit furs at any one time, even whether we're in for a good vintage wine in various parts of the world.
So what are the predictions for this latest sunspot activity?
Well, no one's predicted an election, a revolution in America yet, but you never know. It was only last week that a woman in Spain decided to declare that she'd bought the sun. She laid claim to it and now says anybody who talks about the sun may have to pay her a proper commission.
The sun, before it was taken over by this woman, was worshipped as a deity all over the world. Of course, that makes sense, doesn't it? Because it is the basis of all life.
It's the basis of all life. And it's been seen, obviously, as so powerful. It deals in death as well as in life. It gives us vitamin D, but it also gives us skin cancers, that it's not surprising that people have worshipped it. And when the Christian Church was founded and people decided, when are we going to announce when the birth of Christ should be, the Church really abrogated to itself all the pagan dates. And so the winter solstice, 21st of December to the 25th, people weren't quite sure when to announce it, became the Nativity of Christ.
I do find it interesting that some cultures like the Mayans, also for a period in Egypt, the Pharaoh Atum tried to impose a monotheistic religion based on the fact the sun would be the only god. But you go to Greece and Apollo is not the number one god.
He's not the number one god, and indeed there are some parts of the world where not even number two or three. In Africa, for instance, the sun is obviously seen as immensely powerful, but it brings pestilence and scorchings, and African societies generally worship the earth or worship water as much the superior force.
My guest is Richard Cohen, whose latest book is called Chasing the Sun, the epic story of the star that gives us life. It is published by Random House. Didn't an Oxford professor named Max Muller argue that everything could be traced back to man's relationship with the sun?
It's funny talking about an Oxford professor. He was German. His name sounds as if he ought to be on some comedy TV show. He came over in the mid-19th century to England and ended up professor of religion and professor of philology at Oxford University. He also wrote a best-selling novel. He's quite a man of parts. And Sanskrit was his great subject. That's why he first came over to England. And he said, not only do most languages, certainly in Western Europe, come from Sanskrit, but Sanskrit itself is built on sun images. The first thing that ancient man did was form metaphors, form language around the sun. For obvious reasons, it's up there in the sky giving us life. Now, he went too far, and many people have argued since that it's quite plain that we get our language from a multiplicity of places. But in his day, he was as well-known and as powerful as Darwin. His word carried a great deal of weight.
And his writings would be co-opted by the Nazis. What was Hitler's fascination with the sun?
Well, National Socialism wanted to have some kind of decent intellectual underpinning. And the theorists or apologists for Nazism looked to see who they could really take into their enclave. And they took in Jung, they took in Müller. Jung wrote about the sun too and its power and how it showed that man could be responsible for becoming Superman. They took in Nietzsche as well. And they made a real kind of witch's stew of people whom they only half understood. And Müller was one of those.
Well, Nietzsche would have been horrified by Hitler. He wrote the Anti-During and broke with Wagner because he was critical of anti-Semitism. But it's interesting that we have these emperors all over in Japan, the Incan emperors as well, who are the descendants of the sun.
Well, not just emperors. I mean, if you look at the little red book that Chairman Mao produced, there he is on the cover in a sun-like orb with sun rays going, stretching out from him in every direction. And the most vibrant iconography of the Cultural Revolution is to do with the sun. The current pope, before he was pope in 2002, published a book saying, Christ is the sun, S-U-N, not S-O-N, mm-hmm. and the sun is Christ. Most leaders throughout history have seen the sun as a natural ally.
The Mayans based everything on the sun, didn't they? They built, constructed pyramids that aligned with the sun.
That's true, but not everything. They had various fertility cults. They worshipped corn. If you look at the great headdresses they had, they resemble not so much the sun, whereas, the Western halo is very much a reflection of the sun. So the Mayans had a complicated relationship to the sun. And although they saw it as a great power, they also had fertility gods that they worshipped.
You mention Neil deGrasse Tyson in this book, director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. He makes the point that twice a year the streets of Manhattan are aligned with the sun. So what's to stop some future archaeologists from concluding that the people of New York City were worshippers of a sun goddess?
It'll come. It'll come. I promise you.
By the way, I think we misuse the word. It's nuclear fusion, not nuclear fission, as listeners have pointed out.
Absolutely. I'm sorry. I've got a head cold. So
it's okay.
I hope you can understand me.
We all misspeak. Even I sometimes misspeak. There's documented evidence of sun-dependent building projects within the Roman Catholic Church, for example.
Well, churches and places of worship particularly are aligned for one reason or another to catch the sun's rays, either at the time of solstice or equinoxes. And I reckoned that there are over 3,000 constructions throughout the world. Some people say well over 3,000, which in some way were built to acknowledge the sun, either as a form of worship or as observatories of the sun.
Weren't the physics of the sun, as we understood them at the time, used in developing the atomic bomb?
That's an extraordinary story. I was saying that one of the great questions in the 19th century was, where did the sun get its energy? And in the 1920s and 1930s, you had this extraordinary collection of brilliant physicists, many of whom, first of all, congregated in Copenhagen under Niels Bohr. And several of those were scooped up with the likely coming of war into the Manhattan Project to see if this amazing discovery of nuclear fusion could be used to make a bomb. And so these men of peace found themselves working for a very different purpose.
And then wrote about what they had done, often apologizing for years after the first bombs were dropped.
Some apologized. Some said very clearly, this is a deterrent. It's an important force for good.
When did people start thinking that you could use solar energy to propel things? For example, wasn't there talk before affordable oil defeated solar technology about harnessing the power of the sun way back in the 20s?
Well, it goes even further back. and propelling things. One can go back to the legend of Archimedes turning the sun's rays onto the Roman fleet to burn their sails and destroy the fleet. It goes right back in time. But you're right that in terms of any modern technical use of the sun, it goes back pretty well 100 years. The sad fact is, though, that time after time we've had an advance in how we might use the sun as a source of energy, and yet we don't use it enough.
Well, in the 1880s, there was a solar-powered cotton gin. And didn't Edison imagine that we would be able to harness the power of the sun?
He's full of foresight, as in so many things.
But debated Henry Ford on the matter.
Yeah, he said that he thought it would be the great new source of energy. But the fact we use probably just over 2% of our energy needs we get from the sun. And yet in 44 minutes, the sun gives us as much energy as we need for a year. So we've got a job to do if we're going to use all the energy the sun supplies us.
A part of the problem is coming up with an efficient way to harness that solar power, isn't it? Oil still winds up being a lot cheaper.
So far, but I think a lot of it is government energy, or at least government will. There's enough land in the Mojave Desert that if we really wanted to use that desert for solar energy purposes, we could do far, far more.
Because right now what we're talking about is also windmills and other things, but solar energy is the one thing that does remain constant, doesn't it? We will always have some kind of light from the sun, at least during the daytime.
Well, always is a tricky word, but in terms of your or my lifetimes, that's certainly true.
I was interested to learn that the country that has invested most in solar energy is Germany, which has the least sunlight in all of continental Europe.
But the Germans, in their highly organized way, are, as one always thinks of them, super efficient. And you've got certain towns, like Freiburg, for instance, which are really examples of how to use solar energy. Go anywhere in that city, and on the top of football stadiums, on church roofs, wherever you go, there's an example of the sun being used to help the villagers.
Richard Cohn's latest book is Chasing the Sun, the epic story of the star that gives us life. It's published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.